The Favorite Girl by Monica Arya has become the dark horse sensation of the thriller world this year, with readers and critics alike describing it as disturbingly addictive and impossible to put down despite wanting to look away. This psychological horror thriller has garnered attention from celebrities like Reese Witherspoon, who recently featured it in her book club, calling it a masterclass in sustained tension. The novel has sparked important conversations about human trafficking and the exploitation of vulnerable women, with Arya donating a portion of proceeds to anti-trafficking organizations. What makes this book particularly chilling is how it weaves real-world horrors into its fictional narrative, reminding us that sometimes the most terrifying monsters wear human faces and live in beautiful mansions. 19-year-old Demi Rao knows the difference between surviving and thriving. After escaping a traumatic past in Nashville, she finds herself in a dingy motel room with only $200 hidden in her sock, scanning newspaper classifieds for any opportunity that might keep her off the streets. Her body bears the scars of her coping mechanism, self-inflicted cuts that remind her she's alive and in control of at least some pain in her life. When she spots an ad for a live-in housekeeper position with prominent Dr. Ivory and family in a gated community, it seems like the perfect solution to her desperate situation. The strange requirements for the interview, wearing all white, no jewelry, minimal makeup, unpainted nails, strike her as odd, but not enough to deter her from pursuing what could be her salvation. While preparing for the interview, Demi's luck seemingly turns when she meets Raina, a kind woman who offers her a place to stay for the night. Raina's stunning mansion gives Demi a glimpse into a world of luxury she's only dreamed about. The marble floors, velvet furniture, and gold-encrusted ceilings represent everything she's never had: safety, comfort, and beauty. When Raina discovers Demi will be interviewing with the Ivory family, who live nearby in the same gated community, she offers to help her prepare. "Sometimes we mistake a gilded cage for sanctuary," Raina tells her while helping her dress for the interview. The Ivory family is particular. The warning registers faintly in Demi's mind, but what choice does she have? The alternative is homelessness, vulnerability, and the constant fear that they might find her. Have you ever been so desperate for safety that red flags start to look simply like flags? Demi's situation forces her to ignore her intuition as she walks toward the imposing white mansion on the hill, her borrowed white outfit gleaming in the sunlight, unaware she's walking straight into a nightmare disguised as salvation. The Ivory Estate is a study in monochromatic perfection, everything in shades of white, cream, and ivory. The pristine aesthetic immediately creates an unsettling atmosphere, like walking through a hospital or mausoleum rather than a home. When Demi is greeted by Bradley, a stern man with platinum blonde hair and bright green eyes, wearing strange white foam-soled shoes that make no sound when he walks, her first instinct is discomfort. The hallways are lined with blurry black and white photographs that Demi can't quite make out. When she pauses to examine one that appears to show someone running away, Bradley sharply reprimands her not to ask questions or be meddlesome. This immediate establishment of rigid rules and the suppression of curiosity sets the tone for the controlling environment of the Ivory Estate. Dr. Ian Ivory and his wife Daphne present themselves as the perfect couple, unnaturally beautiful, impeccably dressed in white, and living in a home that could be featured in Architectural Digest. Their son Conrad, handsome and seemingly more normal in regular clothes, though still wearing those strange silent shoes, offers a potential ally in this sterile environment. The interview quickly reveals the bizarre requirements of the position: complete confidentiality, no fragrances, makeup or accessories, all white clothing only, and most disturbingly, mandatory IUD insertion. When Demi questions this last requirement, Conrad uncomfortably explains it's so she doesn't get pregnant and stop working, since his parents prefer long-term staff. Additional rules include making absolutely no sounds in certain sections of the estate, no phone use except after 8 p.m., no photos of the property, weekly weigh-ins, consuming only approved foods, mandatory vitamins, drinking a gallon of water daily, morning walks with monitored step counts, and wearing a provided bracelet at all times. Despite these controlling demands, Demi decides to sign the contract. Her options are limited, with only $3 to her name, and the safety of these walls seems better than the dangers outside, where they might find her. What she doesn't realize is that she's not signing up for a job. She's signing away her freedom. Think about it. How often do we ignore warning signs when the alternative seems worse? The Ivory Estate represents an extreme version of the bargains we sometimes make, trading pieces of our autonomy for security, never realizing the true cost until it's too late. Demi's first glimpse into the true horror of the Ivory Estate comes when Bradley takes her to clean the mysterious ossis wing, later revealed to mean bones. Under strict instructions to make no sound and avoid eye contact with anyone she encounters, Demi enters a room to find a woman chained to a bed, blindfolded and wearing headphones. As she continues her cleaning duties, Demi discovers more women in similar conditions, hairless, thin, with red-streaked green eyes. These are the caged girls, women who have been kidnapped or purchased through a catalog called the Virgin Bride Catalog, and are being conditioned to become submissive wives for wealthy men. The horror of this discovery is compounded when Demi realizes that one of these women is Bradley's sister, Daisy. When Bradley kneels beside her and whispers, "I love you, sis. I'm so sorry. I tried everything. There's no way out of hell," the full weight of the situation crashes down on Demi. Later, she witnesses a selection process where a man named Dr. Mason Davenport browses through binders containing photos of women in underwear, with pages detailing eye colors, hairstyles, and wedding lingerie options. He selects Bradley's sister, choosing forest green contacts and bridal lingerie with a dog collar. Dr. Ivory cruelly forces Bradley to approve the selections for his own sister's enslavement. The most disturbing revelation comes when Demi is forced to watch Daisy's wedding night through a glass wall in a theater-style viewing room. The brutal assault is treated as entertainment, with movie theater concessions provided for the viewers. Dr. Ivory warns that closing their eyes will result in punishment, as cameras are monitoring their reactions. This voyeuristic horror represents the ultimate dehumanization. Not only are these women being abused, but their suffering is being consumed as entertainment. It's a stark commentary on how exploitation can become normalized and even celebrated within closed systems of power. What makes this scenario particularly chilling is how it parallels real-world trafficking operations. While the Ivory Estate is fictional, similar horrors occur in reality, with vulnerable women and girls being sold, conditioned, and exploited. The novel forces us to confront uncomfortable truths about human trafficking and the commodification of women's bodies. As Demi becomes more entrenched in the Ivory Estate, she discovers the horrifying truth about her presence there. She was never hired as a housekeeper at all. She was purchased from a trafficker named Trent Smith in Tennessee and has been the favorite girl all along, hand-selected by Conrad to become his wife and continue the Ivory family legacy. This revelation connects to Demi's traumatic past, which we learn through flashbacks. 2 years earlier, Demi and her sister Lila were sold by their parents and trapped in a trafficking ring. They lived in a closet for 22 hours daily while Lila endured repeated rape and beatings from a man named Trent, who called her his wife. Lila protected Demi. No one ever touched her. She called Demi Demillion because she was her wish come true. When Lila planned Demi's escape, telling her to flee to Charlotte, the Queen City, Trent brutally beat her. Demi found her dying, her body broken beyond repair. At Lila's desperate request, Demi ended her suffering with a nearby knife. Before leaving, she discovered Trent's police badge, realizing they had never stood a chance against a system designed to protect predators. The connection between Conrad and Demi's past becomes clear when he calls her Demillion, the special nickname only her sister used. Conrad reveals that Lila was originally chosen for him, but was rejected for not being pure after Trent had repeatedly assaulted her. Demi also learns that Mrs. Ivory was once a caged girl herself, selected by Ian after his father found her using drugs. She has internalized her captivity, believing women are safest in cages and meant to be submissive and sacrificial. This generational pattern of abuse and Stockholm syndrome reveals how trauma can be perpetuated when victims become complicit in the abuse of others. The concept of the favorite girl takes on multiple meanings throughout the novel. On one level, it refers to the woman chosen to marry into the Ivory family and continue their legacy. On another level, it represents the illusion of specialness and privilege that abusers often use to manipulate their victims, making them feel chosen and valued while simultaneously controlling and dehumanizing them. This psychological manipulation is particularly effective because it plays on basic human desires for acceptance and belonging. Even in her horror, Demi finds herself craving the approval of the Ivories, wondering if she's developing Stockholm syndrome as she begins to adapt to their world.
The pristine white aesthetic of the Ivory estate conceals gruesome secrets. Demi discovers that the strange textured white wall in Dr. Ivory's office is made from the bones of disobedient girls who failed to please the family. The peony garden, with its beautiful flowers, grows over the buried bodies of murdered women, and the sweet peony tea the family drinks is nourished by these remains. Even more disturbing is the revelation about Mrs. Ivory's special room, which contains rows of blonde wigs with name placards, each made from the hair of the trapped girls. The women are systematically stripped of their identity, their hair shaved off, their natural eye color covered with green contacts, their bodies molded to fit the Ivory aesthetic. Dr. Ivory's nighttime visits to the caged girls reveals his predatory nature. He explains to Demi that he visits between 3 to 4 a.m., the devil's landing, claiming this prevents the devil from being superior to him. He refers to the imprisoned women as his precious birds while prowling around Demi's room at night. The house itself becomes a metaphor for the deceptive nature of evil, beautiful and pristine on the surface, rotting and horrific underneath. This duality is reflected in the characters as well, particularly Dr. Ivory, who maintains the facade of a respected physician while engaging in monstrous behavior. The physical layout of the estate, with its maze-like hallways, locked doors requiring key cards, and hidden rooms, reinforces the theme of entrapment. The Ossis wing, with its caged women, represents the literal imprisonment, while the rest of the house, despite its luxury, is equally confining for Demi. This architectural manifestation of control extends to the strange white foam-soled shoes that everyone in the house must wear, ensuring absolute silence. The suppression of sound becomes another form of control. The women's screams and cries are literally silenced, just as their identities and autonomy are erased. The bones in the wall serve as a constant reminder of the fate awaiting those who disobey. As Bradley warns Demi, they're going to kill you if you don't comply, and your bones will join the others. This physical manifestation of threat creates an environment where compliance seems like the only option for survival.
As Demi's wedding to Conrad approaches, the full extent of the Ivory family's disturbed traditions comes to light. The wedding preparations include a bridal fitting where Mrs. Ivory violently tightens Demi's corset until she can barely breathe, giving her two options: be planted in our garden and nurtured as an Ivory family member, or be buried and used as fertilizer. The night before the wedding, Dr. Ivory performs a horrific assault under the guise of removing Demi's IUD, chaining her to the bed, forcibly shaving her, and sexually assaulting her while claiming it was a medical procedure. This violation leaves Demi feeling like a corpse pretending to live on her wedding day. The wedding itself is a macabre affair, with Demi walking down the aisle clutching peonies grown over the buried bodies of murdered girls. She feels their spirits beneath her feet as she robotically says, "I do," while imagining it's Bradley before her. After the ceremony comes the most shocking revelation yet. Conrad leads Demi to discover his parents lying dead with slit throats.
In a sickening ritual, he forces her to drink their blood from wine glasses, explaining they sacrifice themselves as part of the family tradition, and one day they'll do the same for their son and his bride. This ritual sacrifice reveals the cyclical nature of the Ivory family's evil, each generation willingly dying to continue their legacy of abuse and control. It's a twisted perversion of familial love and sacrifice, where death becomes the ultimate gift to ensure the continuation of their disturbed practices. The wedding night brings its own horrors, with Conrad demanding they watch a video of his parents' wedding night as a tradition for good luck. The white towel on the bed, meant to collect blood, proving Demi's virginity, symbolizes the obsession with purity and control that drives the Ivory family's actions. These rituals demonstrate how abuse can be normalized and even sanctified through tradition and ceremony. By wrapping their horrors in the trappings of sacred ritual, the Ivory family creates a framework that makes their actions seem inevitable and even necessary, rather than the monstrous choices they actually are. With Bradley's help, Demi formulates an escape plan. After her wedding night with Conrad, she waits for him to fall asleep before using his key card to unlock all doors in the Ossis wing, desperately urging the caged women to escape. Most are too broken to move, highlighting the devastating psychological effects of prolonged captivity and abuse. Demi meets Bradley's friend Keely, who drives her to Charleston, where Bradley waits with a boat. Their reunion is joyful but short-lived. As they sail away, Demi discovers a photo album showing two little boys with Daphne and Ian Ivory. The unthinkable truth emerges. Ian Ivory was my father. Bradley reveals that his father raped a caged girl who became his mother, and Daphne murdered her. The final betrayal comes when Bradley reveals his intentions to continue the family legacy in the Bahamas, planning to make Demi undergo white therapy to become the perfect wife. The cycle of abuse threatens to continue as Bradley, despite his apparent kindness, proves to be no different from Conrad and Dr. Ivory. In their final confrontation, Demi slips the suicide pill from her locket into one of their champagne glasses, not knowing which of them will drink it. By chance, Bradley consumes the poison. In their struggle, he stabs her and pulls her overboard, but she manages to push him under a wave, whispering, "You were always my favorite Ivory," as he drowns. This devastating twist reveals how trauma can perpetuate itself across generations. Despite being a victim himself, Bradley had internalized the Ivory family's patterns of control and abuse. His betrayal represents the insidious nature of systemic abuse, how it can corrupt even those who seem to be fighting against it. Demi's escape is bittersweet. She manages to pull herself back onto the boat, bleeding and crying, and eventually signals for help with a flare gun. But her final actions, donning a white hat and sunglasses, climbing aboard the rescue boat with a grin, and asking for plain white rice and yogurt, suggests that part of the Ivory conditioning remains with her. "Because, after all, I was the favorite girl," she concludes, indicating that true escape from such profound trauma may never be complete. Beyond the explicit horrors of the Ivory estate lies a more insidious theme: the complicity of society in enabling such abuse. The novel meticulously exposes how trafficking operations persist through complex networks of enablers, customers, and silent observers, each playing a crucial role in perpetuating the cycle of exploitation. Officer Tate embodies the corruption of authority figures who should protect the vulnerable. As a police officer, he represents law and order, yet his involvement with the Ivory business reveals the rot within institutions meant to safeguard society. His treatment of Isabella, whom he returns like damaged merchandise when she fails to submit to his degrading demands, demonstrates how those in power can abuse their position while maintaining a respectable public facade. The wealthy men at Daisy's wedding represent the demand that fuels human trafficking. These respected members of society arrive with binders and highlighters, treating the selection of women as casually as a business merger. Their presence at a formal ceremony, complete with champagne and hors d'oeuvres, normalizes the commodification of human beings.
These men, doctors, lawyers, businessmen, demonstrate how exploitation becomes acceptable when wrapped in the trappings of legitimate commerce. The wealthy men at Daisy's wedding represent the demand that fuels human trafficking. These respected members of society arrive with binders and highlighters, treating the selection of women as casually as a business merger. Their presence at a formal ceremony, complete with champagne and hors d'oeuvres, normalizes the commodification of human beings. These men, doctors, lawyers, businessmen, demonstrate how exploitation becomes acceptable when wrapped in the trappings of legitimate commerce. Reina's character serves as a particularly chilling example of complicity. Her beautiful home, maternal warmth, and apparent concern for trafficking victims create a false sense of security. Her role as an ivory employee who delivers products, the girls, shows how traffickers exploit trust and vulnerability. Her betrayal of Demi illustrates how trafficking networks use women to lure other women, creating layers of deception that make escape nearly impossible. The novel's supporting characters further illuminate this web of complicity. The banker who manages the operation's finances, the corrupt border agents who look the other way, the hotel staff who ignore obvious signs of trafficking, and the neighbors who never question the strange activities at the estate. Each represents a point of failure in society's protective systems. Through these interconnected characters, the author demonstrates how modern slavery persists not through force alone, but through sophisticated networks of social and institutional support. The horror lies not just in Dr. Ivory's sadistic actions, but in the ordinary people who enable him, people who could intervene but choose profit or convenience over human dignity. The author's note crystallizes this theme by connecting fictional horrors to real-world trafficking statistics. By grounding her narrative in actual cases, Aria transforms her novel from mere entertainment into a powerful commentary on contemporary society's role in perpetuating exploitation. The result is a story that haunts readers not just with its fictional horrors, but with the recognition that similar networks of complicity exist in their own communities. Throughout her ordeal, Demi demonstrates remarkable resilience and determination to survive. From her initial self-harm as a coping mechanism, to her final act of self-preservation in choosing her own life over Bradley's, Demi's journey is one of maintaining her core self despite attempts to break and remake her. When her hair is cut and dyed blonde against her will, when she's forced to wear the white uniform of the estate, when she's given a new name and identity as Conrad's fiance, Demi continues to resist internally, even when outward compliance is necessary for survival. Her inner monologue maintains a separate identity from the role she's forced to play. This psychological resistance is perhaps best exemplified when Bradley gives her birth control pills hidden in her shoes, a small but significant act of defiance against the Ivory family's plan to impregnate her. These hidden pills represent Demi's determination to maintain control over her own body despite overwhelming forces attempting to claim ownership of it. Demi's journey raises profound questions about identity and survival. How much can a person endure before losing themselves? What parts of the self remain inviolable even under extreme duress? The novel suggests that while trauma leaves permanent marks, the core self can survive even the most horrific circumstances. The ambiguous ending, with Demi escaping physically but still carrying aspects of her conditioning, acknowledges that recovery from trauma is not a simple or complete process. The final image of Demi asking for plain white rice and yogurt, the food given to the caged girls, while wearing white, the ivory aesthetic, suggests that parts of her captivity will always remain with her, even as she moves forward into freedom. This nuanced portrayal of trauma and survival elevates the novel beyond simple horror, offering insights into the complex psychological effects of captivity and abuse. Demi's story becomes not just a tale of escape from physical imprisonment, but a deeper exploration of how we preserve our humanity in the face of dehumanizing circumstances.